just a little bit more from the Buddha about the Garbha. Another sutra of the Buddha that teaches Tathagata Garbha and seem to be very influential for the Zen tradition is called the Lankavatara Sutra. Legend has it that our Zen founder who brought Zen to China from India only took one thing with him from India to China, and that was a copy of the Lankavatara Sutra. And this sutra, the Buddha says, Tathagata Garbha, Buddha nature. Tathagata Garbha, the mine of the realization of suchness. Tathagata Garbha, this present ordinary awareness. Tathagata Garbha is like an actor who changes appearances in different settings, but who has no individual self. There's another metaphor. Tathagata Garbha can take any form, like an actor playing different parts, but it has no fixed self. Now, we maybe could even go so far as to say that, like this very screen, unchanging, unlocated, boundless computer screen is like an actor that takes the form of 29 of us without having any specific self itself. Could it be that there's actually only one Tathagata Garbha? That might sound far-fetched. Sometimes the sutras imply this. And if we think it seems far-fetched, I think one way to open to this kind of teaching is, again, to make the distinction between awareness, which is ungraspable and ever-present and unchanging, has no distinctions, awareness. It's because anything we call a distinction is an experience happening in awareness. So if we feel and think that there must be some division between my Tokyo's awareness and your awareness, there must be some distinction. If we look carefully, we see any type of distinction we can come up with is an object or an experience within awareness. It could take some time to explore, but it's worth exploring. Any type of distinction, like, well, I, Tokyo, I'm having these thoughts and you're having those thoughts. Yes, we're having different thoughts, but those are experiences. in the field of awareness. It just feels like I'm over here and you're over there. There must be some division between my awareness and your awareness. Any kind of division falls into this category of some type of experience happening within this spaced awareness. The commentary on this case 93 that we're looking at also says that this Tathagatagarbha has three meanings. You could also say aspects, three different viewpoints. It says meanings there. One of them is called delusion. It's one meaning of Tathagatagarbha is delusion. Another meaning of Tathagatagarbha is awakening. And a third meaning that the commentary says is kind of in between the first two is like the essence, which I think is saying that Tathagatagarbha is like essence or the nature of everything. And sometimes it takes the form of delusion, and sometimes it takes the form of awakening. But the essence of delusion and the essence of awakening are the same essence. So there's kind of like three different names for Tathagatagarbha. The Lankavatara Sutra also says, when this Tathagatagarbha is infused or even impregnated by habitual patterns of fixed reference points, it's called the storehouse consciousness. The sutra is pretty verbose. It's kind of surprising that Bodhidharma, who just kind of sat and faced the wall of a cave and never said very much, this was the only book he carried around. Maybe he just embodied these words so much that then he could just put the book on the side of the cave and sit there. This Lankavatara Sutra says in kind of a verbose way. And it's using this language, interestingly using this language of impregnation. And we're talking about this garbha that also means womb. So these are all sort of ways of talking about this non-physical realm. If we think of Tathagatagarbha as a womb, when this womb of Buddha nature is impregnated by habitual patterns of fixed reference points or holding reference points, you could say that's what we have. We have these habitual patterns that we enact over and over again of holding fixed reference points, which maybe means in more simple language, like I feel like I'm a person in a body over here looking at you people in bodies over there. It's over here and over there are called prapancha or reference points. And like that's up and that's down and that's left and that's right. She was backwards for you. Anyway, those are my fixed reference points. That's left. Actually, that's right for you, isn't it? Which just goes to show that we can have these fixed reference points and they might be different and they're not really so valid. when the Buddha's womb, the Tathagatagarbha, is impregnated by these fixed reference points of up and down, right and left, it is called the storehouse consciousness, which, without making a lengthy story, is another teaching of the Buddha, the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness that gives rise to all delusion. And that's what the Buddha says here. When the Tathagatagarbha and Buddha nature is infused or impregnated by these habitual patterns of fixed reference points, it's called the storehouse consciousness, which gives rise to delusion and all the other consciousnesses. And then the sutta says, this Buddha nature storehouse consciousness, this is unusual in this sutra for people who are into these kind of like teachings. This is the only sutra that kind of like mingles the Tathagatagarbha and the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. So in Sanskrit, it actually says that the Tathagatagarbha alaya vijnana is pure, but it's obscured by afflictions like greed, hate, and delusion. So if that seemed like a heady, verbose description, you can forget about it. And instead, hear a Zen story about Nanchuan, who's the one who's the protagonist in this case. Nanchuan's the one who's talking about the garba and the jewel, being asked about it, responding. So Nanchuan's maybe most famous in the Zen world for cutting a cat in two. But let's not get into that today. It's a messy story. Instead, here's a story that's less famous about Nanchuan. Officer Lu Gong, some town mayor or something like that, some government officer, invited Nanchuan to expound the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. And Nanchuan said to him, well, what would you like me to say? And Officer Liu said, well, can't you offer some skillful means for people to enter the way? Nanchuan said, what do you think is lacking? And Officer Liu said, well, then why are there these realms of samsaric birth and death? Nothing's lacking. Why is all this birth and death? And Nanchuan said, well, I don't teach that. This is another quality aspect of a Buddha nature that it doesn't lack anything. There's nothing missing in Buddha nature. There's nothing that can be added to it. or subtracted from it. Because it's unchanging. So we might say conventionally, well, there is this appearance of birth and death, of course, but non-chuan, and I guess a kind of an ultimate moment is, but I don't teach that. So aren't there any skillful means to help people enter the way? Here's another story of non-chuan that you might have heard, a really great story in which non-chuan awakens the great Zhaozhou to the way. Zhaozhou, who lived to be 120, is when he was a young novice practicing with non-chuan, asked his teacher, non-chuan, what is the way? Which in Zen usually means Buddha. And non-chuan says, ordinary mind is the way. People often misunderstand this ordinary mind. That just means my like habitual pattern mind. But it looks like the Zen ancestors, that wasn't how they usually talked about ordinary mind. In fact, Chinese, Sino-Japanese, it's Heijo Shin, and that means like continuous mind. And sometimes they say everyday mind, meaning like it's the mind that's the same every day. Really has this word for like permanence or continuous in it, jo. So I think ordinary is good because it means it's very ordinary. It's not special. It's not a special mind. And yet it's an always mind. It's that kind of ordinary. It's not special and it's always the case. In fact, that's why it's not special. Special usually means a rare kind of mind. This is an ordinary mind. It's always the case. And it's not special. It's this very awareness. What is the way? The Buddha way? Ordinary mind is the way. And Zhaozhou then asks them, well, should I direct myself towards it? Which I think means like, well, how can I get this kind of ordinary mind? Should I like direct my attention towards it? And non-chuan says, if you direct your attention towards it, you become separate from it. This great Buddha nature teaching. If you try to direct your mind towards Buddha nature as another experience, that you just separate it from it. That's the realm of duality. Mind knowing experiences is duality. And so then Zhaozhou very nicely asks, well, if I don't direct myself towards it as an experience, then how can I know it? How can I know the way? Good question. And non-chuan says, the way is not a matter of dualistic knowing, like knowing it as an object, or a matter of like blank not knowing. It's not like, well, just forget about it then. You can't do anything about it. You can't know it as an experience, but it's not just like, don't just make your mind blank either. Those are, again, two sort of dichotomies. Nanchuan says dualistic knowing is delusion, basically. And blank not knowing at all is just confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond any doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as space. How can this be talked about on a level of affirmation and negation? How can this fit into the categories of existence or non-existence? And it said, Zhao Zhou felt like he was drinking ambrosia when he heard this. He was drinking sweet dew, the nectar of the gods. So, to review the story at hand again, case 93 in the Book of Sui, Lu Tzu or somebody else, some other name, asked Nanchuan, quoting the old poem, people don't recognize the wish-fulfilling jewel intimately obtained from within the Jatagata Gaira. Let's talk about that line of the old poem. Lutsu asks, Nanchuan, what is this garba? What is this storehouse? What is this heart? What is this essence? The Buddha. Nan said, it is me coming and going with you. I think Thomas Cleary translates it as, it is that in me which comes and goes with you. Another translator puts it as, Nanchuan doesn't say me, he uses his own name, his family name, Wang. People called him Wang Roshi. This might be the earliest story I've ever heard this term Roshi being used in. And it's interesting that he calls himself that too. But his family name, Nanchuan's family name is Wang. So he said, Wang Roshi. Roshi means old teacher. Old teacher Wang exchanges questions and answers with you. It's another translation. Another translator puts it as, it's the give and take of you and me. Literally, the Chinese says, coming and going. I think we could say. And it has you. So it's like, what is this heart of the Buddha? What is this Gara? It is me coming and going with you. And then Lu Tzu said, what about that which doesn't come and go? And Nanchuan said, that's also the Garba, the nature. So I think in this kind of Zen conversation, they do a nice job of talking about these two aspects of Buddha nature. And again, going back to the screen that we're looking at right now, I think it's best to actually start with that which doesn't come and go. So to start, first understand that Buddha nature is the screen which doesn't come and go. As Sri Maladevi said, this Tathagata Garbha is eternal and unchanging. It's unborn and undying and indestructible. And then Shimala Devi also said, and it's the basis, support, and foundation of everything. Buddha qualities and deluded qualities are conditioned phenomena. Just like this screen is the basis, support, and foundation for all these people's faces. These people's faces that are coming and going. And the nature of each face that's arising and ceasing is nothing other than the screen. Right? So Nanchuan says, when asked, what is this Tathagatagarbha? First, he gets into the coming and going part. Right? It's me coming and going with you. So it's kind of like our interdependence. Just like right now, like there's this face talking on the screen, and then there's your face over there hearing. So there's the faces are, you could say, interdependent, and they're coming and going inconceivably, interdependently. This realm of interdependence is the realm of coming and going, just like the faces on the screen. And these faces on the screen are the screen, right? They are the Tathagatagarbha. Well, maybe that was a little surprising, because usually what's emphasized most with the Tathagatagarbha teachings is the not coming and going, is the unchanging. So maybe because it's a Zen story, what is this essence of Buddha? Maybe Lutzi was expecting Nanchuan to say the eternal unchanging, but instead he said, it's me coming and going with you. When I first read that, I thought it was a little surprising. From the Tathagatagarbha point of view. But we can see, right, that Tathagatagarbha is these faces and these sounds coming and going interdependently and inconceivably interdependently. Well, what about that which doesn't come and go, which is like the support for all this coming and going? That's also the Tathagatagarbha. And we might even say that's also the Tathagatagarbha, and that's the usual way of talking about Tathagatagarbha. But I gave you the unusual way first, the two. Can you follow that? I think it's a nice way of bringing out this, in a simple Zen story, these two dimensions, inseparable dimensions of the Tathagatagarbha, that which doesn't come and go, and that which comes and goes. They're inseparable, right? Just like the images on the screen are inseparable from the screen. It's not like there's one realm over here where things are coming and going, and another realm over here, it's not coming and going. It's one event called an unchanging screen displaying itself as a bunch of changing images. So that's a nice Zen exposition of Tathagatagarbha. It's me coming and going with you, and it is that which doesn't come and go ever. And then Lutzu went on to say, let's go through every piece of this poetic verse here. What's the jewel? What is this wish-fulfilling jewel that's intimately obtained from within the Tathagatagarbha? And the commentary on the koan here says this Sanskrit word mani, which I said earlier means jewel, and it's short for chintamani, which means like wish fulfilling jewel. This word means in Chinese and Japanese, in Chinese we translate it, the commentator Wang Zhang says, we call it ruyi. In Japanese we call it nyoi. And anagi seeing these curvy sticks of Zen teachers, which don't have around right now, but they're sometimes called ruyi or nyoi, Japanese. It's a translation of chintamani, actually. It's a wish-fulfilling stick. And these things go way back in China. Interestingly, you see them like in Chinese shops in China and like in Chinatown. You see them in shop windows, these curvy sticks. Sometimes they're like jewel encrusted. And so they're kind of pre-Zen sticks. They're like emperors had. It seems maybe that the origin is it's a stylized version of a reishi mushroom. And still you see these nyoi sticks in China that look exactly like a reishi mushroom, like a curve with the head curved over. This is sort of like a magical mushroom in the old days in China. And ruyi or nyoi in Chinese literally means as you wish, as you like it. As you wish is a nice way to put it. I think this kind of means like wish fulfilling. But it kind of means wish fulfilling. But kind of like as you wish, as you intend. E is like thought. As you think, so it is. That's the kind of jewels these are. That's the kind of sticks these are. They're like, as you think it, so it is, stick. So the commentary says that's in China, that's how we talk about these chintamani jewels and sticks. And also, Wang Zhang says, in China, it's called, these jewels are called undefiled light, pure luminosity. I never heard that elsewhere, but that's what they're called. Ancient commentator says, that's the kind of thing that you find hidden in the Tathagata womb. You find, as you wish, pure luminosity. So in the story here, Lutzi said, well, what is this jewel? What is this wish-fulfilling jewel? And Nanchuan said, Teacher Lutzu. And Lutzu said, yes. And Nanchuan said, you can go now. You're not meeting with my words. In the commentary, it says, then Lutzu, whoever this was, Shutsu, was awakened and later became the successor of Nanchuan. So we heard a lot about this inconceivable, we've heard a lot of conceptions about this inconceivable Buddha nature, this Tathagata Garbha, that never comes and goes, but appears as all coming and going. And and is empty of all greed, hate, and delusion, but not empty of Buddha qualities, love and compassion. So this vast mind, storehouse, womb, heart, essence is filled with these wish-fulfilling jewels. And what is the jewel? Lutsu asks. And Antoine says, Lutsu! And Lutsu says, yes. We don't know exactly how he said it. He responded. I left a long gap there. Yes. But maybe it was like, Lutsu, yes. And where's the jewel? Lutsu and his immediate, uncontrived response. Maybe even there was a long pause and hesitating answer. Yes, teacher? What do you want to tell me? Even then, you could say it's uncontrived. It's just a response. He responded. But nothing's missing there. It's free functioning. It's within the Tathagata Garbha. There's this natural, spontaneous expression and response to situations, which is how the Buddha qualities of love and compassion, how I would understand them, is it's not like, well, let's try to be nice to people. Not that kind of love and compassion. That's okay too. I mean, sometimes that's really like, you know, I get angry a lot. Let me really train in patience. That's valid too. But I think that the Buddha qualities of love and compassion that are inherent and natural to Buddha nature are spontaneous. That love is the recognition of our shared being, that we can't find any actual distinction between my awareness and your awareness, except for just images and screens that seem to separate them. And therefore, the Buddha nature is our shared being. And that would be one way of talking about love. And then that can be expressed as, like, may I help you? Like, what can I do? And compassion, likewise, in this uncontrived Buddha quality way, could be not so much of like, let me figure out how to help this person, but a spontaneous response. Because we share this reality of Buddha nature, if I, Kokyo, am caught up in my obscurations and can't find it, then I, Kokyo, can have compassion for this person that's temporarily obscuring his Buddha nature. Natural compassion. And if somebody else seems to be obscuring Buddha nature due to habitual patterns impregnating the womb with fixed reference points, then natural compassion can also arise. Because we share this reality of peace and contentment, and we want all of us to accord with that and enjoy that, then that would be one way of looking at this natural Buddha compassion. It's like, if part of me is is stuck and I want to free. It wants to free. Buddha wants to free that part. So like the jewel is like the functioning of Tathagatagarbha, the spontaneous freedom that as you like it, jewel, as you wish, so may it be. Pure luminosity is the wish-fulfilling jewel, expressing itself in all kinds of just ordinary ways. And that's what's so great about these Zen stories. Instead of talking about some highfalutin Buddha love and compassion, what's the wish-fulfilling jewel hidden in the Tathagatagarbha? Lutsu. Yes? Immediate, uncontrived responsiveness. Which sounded pretty good. And the story could have been complete there, but Nan Chuan said at that point, "You can go now because you don't meet with my words." Did he really not meet with Nan Chuan's words? I think here we're talking about intimate meeting. Like, here's the word, Lutsu. Yes? Did this yes meet with Lutsu? Lutsu? Yes? Lutsu? Yes? Lutsu? Yes? Is there meeting or not? Nan Chuan said, you don't meet with my words. But then interestingly, in the commentary, it is said that actually, Lutsu, upon hearing, go away, you don't meet with my words, completely met and awakened to the way. Anything to clarify about this story today? How the wish-fulfilling jewel spontaneously functions for the benefit of beings.
I have a question.
Eleanor.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for this. So interesting. And my question is, you said earlier about, like, this does seem like we kind of get into the Indian philosophers and how both and neither both and both are both and there's something empty in the emptiness and
empty and not empty.
Empty and not empty. So I was thinking about how, not to drag this out too far, but you know, like there's so much science about meditation right now and how it changes the mind. And then, I heard another teacher recently say, like, but everything changes the mind, you know, like interacting changes the mind and how some of this is experienced and some of this we sort of need to be taught and then we experience it. My question is, do you think this teaching, how do you think this teaching came about, this idea of the Tathagatagarbha, that it was experienced and then the philosophers were like trying to explain it? Or did they get themselves so wound up that they had to then like reverse justify it? And then they're like, well, that does kind of work that way. I'm just curious what your sense of that is.
My sense is that the experience came first. Hmm. And sometimes it's talked about that way in the Indian traditions, that I'm particularly thinking Tibetan traditions will say it just like that, that they say there's these other emptiness teachings like Nagarjuna's middle way, that comes from all this, lots of philosophical reasoning, analysis, and logic. It's a lot. Nagarjuna is, I think it's fair to say, is very much based on very precise logical reasoning in order to arrive at the conceptual understanding of emptiness and then the complete non-conceptual understanding. And it's arrived at through logic. And then these Buddha nature teachings, they say they're not really arrived at through logic, actually. They're based on experience. And then there is a lot of these more complex teachings that then explain the experience. And they'll even say, like, the more meditative traditions, the yogis who are doing a lot of meditation tend to gravitate more towards the Buddha nature teachings because they're arriving at this experience. Whereas the religions tend to veer more towards like the middle way teachings of Nirvana because it's like flawless logic and you can prove it. So it is often said to be, it's more connected with like yogic practice kind of on the cushion, this Buddha nature tradition. And that's maybe also why that's the one book that Bodhidharma carried with him.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I think it's nice because then as we start to get into the explanations, those kind of fit together nicely, I think. And they do a good job, I think, in the Tathagata Gautama teachings of explaining it. But I think, yeah, I could say first there's the realization. Wait, there is something unchanging. Not something, but there is this unchanging reality here that's undeniable. When we're, I think the simplest way to come about this is to just ask ourselves, am I aware? And we can, you know, putting aside all the detailed questions about what exactly this awareness is and so on, if we just ask, am I aware? Everyone can answer yes. A three-year-old, anyone who can understand the question, if they stop and look and check, well, yeah, of course I'm aware. And there's never been a time when I've not been aware. If there was, I don't know about it. Because everything I've ever known is happening in awareness. And so it's undeniable experientially and simply. And then we can get the teachings going around it. Whereas the emptiness Nagarjuna is talking about is not so easy to explain that to a three-year-old. Oscar.
Thank you, Kokyo. So I'm thrown into confusion by your explication of the last lines of the story. Lutsu, yes, go away. You don't get me. I thought that seemed clear enough, but you're presenting the thesis that there was the meeting. Lutsu, yes, the meeting.
Isn't that a meeting?
It is a meeting. And so is that... what came to my mind was there's nothing missing in Tathagata Garbha. There's nothing that can be added. There's nothing missing. And also, Nanchuan to Officer Liu, I don't teach that. But the teaching I got was, oh, he missed it. The teaching that I first got, because so could you talk a little more about that?
Well, it's an interesting koan, right, to take up for that reason. I think, yeah, the last part is in a way the most juicy after we got some more straightforward teachings about Tathagata Garbha. So yeah, I mean, there are other Zen stories like someone asks, what's the undefiled wisdom of all the Buddhas, something like this, right? And the teacher says, I'll show you. And he calls a boy who's walking by over and says, hey. And the boy turns his head and the teacher says, isn't that the undefiled wisdom of all the Buddhas? It's kind of like that. And then that story goes on. Well, what about the fundamental affliction of ignorance? And the teacher says to the boy, what is your Buddha nature? And the boy gets totally flustered and freaked out and like runs away. And the teacher says, isn't that the fundamental affliction of ignorance? In the same person. So it seems like this call and response, immediate meeting in that story is really demonstrating the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. Same situation here. Lutsu, yes. And then we can wonder if it's the kind of yes he responded with, like, instead of just yes, was it like, yeah, like, what do you want to ask me next? Oh, that's too much. Or was it like a complete meeting and Nan Chuan, just to test Lutsu, said, well, you don't meet with my words, just to see if, you know, if Lutsu really met. And then that's why when he said, you don't meet with my words, Lutsu fully like opened to the meeting at that point. Be another take on it.
Right. I see.
Something like, and what is meeting with words? These Zen stories all seem to come in words and directly meeting with words. I have a lot of Zen stories like this, like in the Dual Mirror Samadhi. They say, Yi, with his archer's skill, could hit a target at 100 paces. He was like a really skilled archer, could always hit the bullseye in Zazen by himself on the cushion. But then Dongshan says, but when arrow points meet head on, what has this to do with the power of skill? Lutsu, yes, this has nothing to do with the power of skill. And I think we could say that about the natural Buddha qualities, intimately obtained from within Tathagatagarbha, are not skills. I think that's an important point too. They're not like skills, they're natural and complete. We can work on, you know, how to maybe tune them in different situations or something. But like arrow points meeting. Lutsu? Yes. Is that a wish fulfilling jewel? So simple. Jim.
Yes. I don't think this is really right, but a fun way to look at the Lutsu or Shitsu or whoever it is. A fun way to look at it is, he asks, what is the jewel? And Nan Chuan says, Lutsu. So I don't know what the tone of that lutsu was, but you know, it could be, you know, something like that.
Yes.
And the yes is just extraneous. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
And that's why the meeting, that's why that would be one understanding of why you didn't meet with my words, is because the yes was extraneous.
Yeah.
Because Lutsu and Jim and Oscar are the jewels, and there's nothing further to the story than that. Each of the images on the screen are the jewels budding forth from the screen for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah, maybe it's partly right then. But you know, when you're talking about coming and going, it was kind of also bringing to mind in our study group over here. We've been for months looking at the Mountains and Waters Sutra, and with the commentary from Shohaku Okamura, and this very similar discussion about coming and going, and about coming and going in the mountains. According to Shohaku, the mountains in that sutra, he feels, or scholars feel, represents dependent origination, and people are, you know, and we're all coming and going in the mountains, and there's this other quality of mountains, which is completely stable and not flowing. You have this also metaphor between flowing and not flowing. So I was just, you know, from that reading, I get the, you know, the very similar kind of overlap between what we're talking about today. There's a place where it comes where it's hard to say more about it, but I feel that what we're talking about is an awareness that can be relaxed and open to both these aspects of coming and going and complete stability. And it's, you know, it's an awareness that just can live in the midst of that situation.
You might even say the awareness is that situation. The awareness is the unchanging, empty space, and the awareness is all its manifestations, the coming and going.
Right.
In other words, the experiences that come and go are nothing in addition to the knowing of them. And the knowing of them is essentially unchanging. So I think in all these cases, maybe the key point is, one key point is that the unchanging, the not coming and going, and the coming and going are simultaneous. It's not like they alternate. And that's true non-duality. And it sounds totally paradoxical, but again, we can look at the screen. So we really are seeing the screen right now, and we really are seeing the images, and we're not really alternating between them. We're seeing them simultaneously, mostly into the images as sentient beings. And we can open to the screen maybe sometimes, maybe deep samadhi without any images at all. But the non-duality teachings are saying that's not so important, really, except maybe just to really get in touch with the unchanging quality of the screen. But what's really important is to be able to verify the unchanging nature of the screen simultaneously with the changing nature, the changing expression of the screen.
Thank you.
Ken?
Yes. So who or what comes and goes, and awareness is someone aware? Is it my ego? Is my ego have awareness, or is awareness just there? Am I just being awareness, and ego tries to come into the picture, so to speak?
Yeah. And
aware and ego gets frightened or something and goes away, and then you're back into just being awareness.
This is an important point. Yeah, that usually the way we think as humans, that like, to take it a few steps, we could even say we often feel as if we are a body in which there's a mind, and then the mind can sometimes access this vast awareness. I think that's a way sentient beings often think, but it's exactly the opposite of the reality. In Buddha nature perspective, it's like first there's this unchanging awareness. It, in a way, kind of like expresses itself as an individual mind that can perceive dualistically. And then that individual mind projects the experience of a body. It's like, you could even take these three parts, exactly the opposite of our usual perception. So it's quite different point of view, right? Because the ego could mean like the sense of being an independent self that is like, is the body and is this body and mind. Sometimes we talk about, the Buddha would say, this sense of separate self, it's an illusion, is that I am this body and this individual mind. Five skandhas, that's who I am. That's the fundamental illusion in all schools of Buddhism. And you could say the way that this teaching unravels that is awareness comes first, and quite radical Buddhist teaching. It only appears in the Buddha nature teachings, is that Buddha nature starts being called our true self, particularly the Parinirvana Sutra. It's like a major theme. And this sutra is a major sutra, especially in China. It's an Atman. It's another name for Buddha nature. Is the Atman, the true self. But it's not an individual, right? It's not, that's a key point. It's not like my Buddha nature. It's a shared, indivisible awareness. And that's who we really are. And then that expresses itself as, we could say, first an individual mind, and then the mind projects a body. I guess that's kind of the usual Buddhist take. That's this thing about the storehouse consciousness. Is it like an individualized, localized expression of indivisible Buddha nature, Buddha? And then the storehouse consciousness in these teachings expresses itself as what we call a body. But a body is nothing more than physical sensations. And if we look at it, it's sights. And if we tap on it, it sounds. It's nothing but experiences happening in the field of awareness, right? But this is, it's so opposite from how we usually think. In the materialism view, is first there's a bunch of inert matter called like planet Earth with no awareness anywhere. And then that matter starts somehow evolving into these cellular organisms that have some, start subtly generating something like consciousness, and then it evolves into these human consciousnesses that can start meditating on their unlimited Buddha nature. That's like completely opposite story than the tradition. So therefore it's hard to completely like overturn our usual way of thinking, which, you know, maybe is obvious in that explanation, but we can't start with the view of like that material gives rise to awareness. That's I think none of these none of the Buddhist traditions hold that view, but that's the most common view of scientific materialism in the modern Western world. So it's, we've heard that view of, I'm calling materialism, for a long time. I mean, there's centuries, it wasn't always, but for some centuries, it's the dominant paradigm of reality. So, and I think Buddhism, this is a little bit, I'm getting on a sidetrack rant here. Excuse me. I think modern, especially Western Buddhism, because we're in this scientific materialist culture, we just assume that we try to fit Buddhism into the package of materialism. And it can get a little bit down the road. It can help some, but it would, I think we have to really let go of this scientific materialist view. And luckily, science is starting to not do it itself, right? Quantum physics starting to say, well, actually the observer seems to be affecting material. That's weird. Now the Buddhists can be like, okay, finally, we're starting to get over this materialist view. And so there's a big question we can contemplate for the rest of our life. Can we have authentic Buddha Dharma fit into the view of scientific materialism? The koan, take home.
Does it need to?
I would say it can't, actually. It will never be able to. Some Buddhist practices and some teachings can, but I think they're not the whole picture. And so not only does it not need, luckily it doesn't need to, because I think it can't.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So.
I see Cody.
Well, oh, Cody, sorry. Your hand's way up in the corner.
Couldn't see. Thank you. I guess I wanted to ask about why do you think that over the development of Buddhism since its origin, that the emphasis was on more placed on the deconstruction of a thing to come to the conclusion of emptiness rather than starting from the teaching of this teaching that we're going over today. The only thing I can think of is, you know, the dominant philosophy at the Buddhist time was one of having the jiva or individual soul or something like that. And it was basically a way to counter that strongly held emotional philosophical concept. But it almost seems like you have to construct something to deconstruct it. And that always frustrates me, because it's like, why do I have to do that extra work?
You're talking about kind of like Nagarjuna's method and logical analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like constructing something in order to deconstruct it. Yeah, I think that's true. But that's the method. It's a skillful means, and it's amazing, amazing skillful means. Nagarjuna is sometimes seen to be like the second Buddha. It's like, and he consciously was doing that. It's like, we know we're conceptual beings. We're thinking all the time, but our thinking is constantly faulty. Our logic is faulty without examining it. So let's examine very closely and carefully using logic, and our very own sharp, clear logic will reveal that nothing is the way it appears to be. It can't be. And that's shocking to us. And so, it's a method, using logic to undo faulty logic and eventually go beyond all logic. And it's not that different, I think, the Buddha nature teachings, because they're also, you could say, they're not deconstructing things using so much complex logic. But they are, in a way, you could say, they're deconstructing things to see that things are manifestations of awareness instead of physical, solid, separate, you know, self-arisen things. They're just, the so-called things are nothing more than the knowing of these things. I think that's the pithiest meditative approach to this. We're looking at something, and there's a knowing of that thing. And we think, yes, there's knowing of this thing, like seeing is a kind of knowing. We're seeing something, we're knowing it. And then we think there's seeing, and then there's a thing over there that I'm seeing. That's two different realms. And we could say, why are we projecting that there's something in addition to the knowing of it? We know there's knowing. Just like, are we aware? Yes. So there is, experientially, there's knowing. But do we need to posit something in addition to the knowing of the thing? We usually do unconsciously posit a thing, but we don't need to. So that's kind of a deconstruction of things, but a more experiential one than a logical.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Malia.
Oh, thank you. I don't know if I understood you correctly. Did you say earlier that greed, hate, and delusion arises from Buddha nature, but then is not itself Buddha nature?
Very good. Yeah, that I think is what the sutra said. Yeah.
So what
interesting
is
interesting way of putting it, huh?
Yeah, but I'm kind of stuck. So yeah. What is the transformational thing then? Like, what is the extra ingredient that gives rise to greed, hate, and delusion?
Well, what gives rise to it is these habitual tendencies that have their own kind of dependent arising, you know, laws of like dependent on past greed, hate, and delusion. There's present greed, hate, and delusion, and it's been going on this way virtually beginninglessly, the teachings say. So, and it's all illusion, but it's got this strong momentum to it, so it keeps going. But one way to talk about, to kind of, maybe as an analogy to describe, how could it be that that Buddha nature could give rise to greed, hate, and delusion that aren't actually it itself? We could think of like the sky has all this moisture in it, but it's just pure blue, clear sky, but it's got this moisture, and then the moisture starts to congeal into clouds. So in a way we could say these wisps of clouds are really just nothing other than the sky itself, kind of the moistness of the sky congealing. And then it congeals more and more, and they become really solid-looking clouds with sharp edges and black thunder clouds. But it's really just like congealed sky. And then at some point, like the clouds are completely blocking the clearness of the sky. So we could say they're made of the sky. They've arisen out of the sky, but and they share the nature of the sky. But they're also, you could say, they're not necessary to the sky. I think that's what it means by they're not actually, greed, hate, and delusion are not really part of Buddha nature. I think is what his meaning is, that they're not intrinsic to Buddha nature. They seem to be blocking, the clouds seem to be blocking the sky, and yet they've arisen from the sky. Bizarre. And that's how it is. In fact, I don't think I've ever written here, but I think what in the Srimala Devi Sutra, there's a nice conclusion, I think at the end, where the Buddha is praising Srimala Devi for her teachings. And I think he says something like, there are two things that are like inconceivably amazing in this world, like inconceivable amazing in this world. One is that Buddha nature is like perfectly pure and can never be defiled at all. And is always present, something like that. That's amazing and inconceivable. And the other one that's amazing and inconceivable is that beings can like obscure that Buddha nature by their own. It's obscurations that come from Buddha nature can obscure the Buddha nature. That is amazing and inconceivable. And I would agree. Yeah, and then there's lots of stories of, it's not just random to be hate and illusion. You could say that's the whole story of, especially the storehouse consciousness is a nice story to explain how this storehouse keeps being reborn. It's not some entity being reborn, but it's collection of delusion churning around and getting added to constantly and giving rise to new delusion. And that keeps giving rise to new delusion over eons. And then, but we heard in the Lankavatara Sutra that actually that storehouse is just the Tathagatagarbha kind of distorted by obscurations. It's an obscured version of the Tathagatagarbha.
Thank you.
Well, how about we continue with some enjoying the space of ever-present awareness? And remember, as you're sitting during zazen, that if thoughts are rising, I can't find this space of Buddha nature. We know it's always there. We feel like we can't find it. We can just ask ourselves, well, who is it that's having this thought? I can't find it. And it's right there. So it's like, it doesn't need to be like lost in the clouds. Negate the merit of our discussions today and our day of sitting. To all beings everywhere, especially all those suffering with the obstructions blocking the perfectly pure, ever-present, loving, compassionate Buddha nature. May our intentions and efforts radiate outwards towards all beings throughout space and time. Open a tiny hole in each cloud that can grow and grow till it becomes nothing but sky.